Chapter 31. £1,000, 10 nice, neat, crisp 100-pound notes, and go away with you, do. I will have my bond, sir, or nothing, I said, and I put on an attitude of resolution which I confess surprised even myself. Worry veil, he shrieked, with many oaths, then you shall have noting, ah, 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 noting but a policeman. Mr. Abednego, call a policeman. Take that, you humbug and impostor. And here with an abundance of frightful language which I dare not repeat, the wealthy banker abused and defied me. About due compte, what was I to do, if a banker did not choose to honor a check drawn by his dead grandmother? I began to wish I had my snuff box back. I began to think I was a fool for changing that little old-fashioned gold for this slip of strange paper. Meanwhile, the banker had passed from his fit of anger to a paroxysm of despair. He seemed to be addressing some person invisible, but in the room. Look here, ma'am, you've really been coming it too strong. 100,000 in 6 months, and now 1,000 more. The house can't stand it. It won't stand it, I say. What? Oh, mercy, mercy. As he uttered these words, a hand fluttered over the table in the air. It was a female hand. That which I had seen the night before. That female hand took a pen from the green baize table, dipped it in a silver inkstand, and wrote on a quarter of a sheet of fool's cap on the blotting book, "How about the diamond robbery? If you do not pay, I will tell them where they are." What diamonds? What robbery? What was this mystery? That will never be ascertained, for the wretched man's demeanor instantly changed. Certainly, sir. Oh, certainly, he said, forcing a grin. How will you have the money, sir? All right, Mr. Abednego. This way out. I hope I shall often see you again, I said, on which I own poor Manasseh gave a dreadful grin, and shot back into his parlor. I ran home, clutching the 10 delicious, crisp 100 pounds, and the dear little 50 which made up the account. I flew through the streets again. I got to my chambers. I bolted the outer doors. I sank back in my great chair, and slept. My first thing on waking, was to feel for my money. Perdition! Where was I? Ha! On the table before me was my grandmother's snuff box, and by its side one of those admirable sensation novels, which I had been reading, and which are full of delicious wonder. But that the guillotine is still, to be seen at Mr. Gale's, number 47 I Holborn, I give you my honor. I suppose I was dreaming about it. I don't know. What is dreaming? What is life? Why shouldn't I sleep on the ceiling? And am I sitting on it now, or on the floor? I am puzzled. But enough. If the fashion for sensation novels goes on, I tell you I will write one in 50 volumes. For the present, Dixie. But between ourselves, this Pinto, who fought at the Colosseum, who was nearly being roasted by the Inquisition, and sang duets at Holyrood, I am rather sorry to lose him after three little bits of roundabout papers. Et vous? Bergenov, I, at a table d'hôte, at the close of February, 1848 I was in Nuremberg. My original intention had been to pass a couple of days there on my way to Munich, that being, I thought, as much time as could reasonably be spared for so small a city, beckoned as my footsteps were to the Bavarian Athens, of whose glories of ancient art and German Renaissance I had formed expectations, the most exaggerated expectations fatal to any perfect enjoyment, and certain to be disappointed, however great the actual merit of Munich might be. But after 2 days at Nuremberg I was so deeply interested in its antique sequestered life, the charms of which had not been deadened by previous anticipations, that I resolved to remain there until I had mastered every detail, and knew the place by heart. I have a story, to tell which will move amidst tragic circumstances of too engrossing a nature, to be disturbed by archaeological interests, and shall not, therefore, minutely describe here what I observed in Nuremberg, although no adequate description of that wonderful city has yet fallen in my way. the readers unacquainted with this antique place, it will be enough to say that in it the old German life seems still to a great extent rescued from the all-devouring, all-equalizing tendencies of European civilization. The houses are either of the 15th and 16th centuries, or are constructed after those ancient models. The citizens have preserved much of the simple manners and customs of their ancestors. The hurrying feet of commerce and curiosity pass rapidly by, leaving it sequestered from the agitations and the turmoils of metropolitan existence. It is as quiet as a village. During my stay there rose in its quiet streets the startled echoes of horror at a crime unparalleled in its annals, which, gathering increased horror from the very peacefulness and serenity of the scene, arrested the attention and the sympathy in a degree seldom experienced. Before narrating that, it will be necessary to go back a little, that my own connection with it may be intelligible, especially in the fanciful weaving together of remote conjectures which strangely involved me in the story. The table d'hôte at the Bayerischer Hof had about 30 visitors all, with one exception, of that local commonplace which escapes remark. Indeed, this may almost always be said of tables d'hôte, though there is a current belief, which I cannot share, of a table d'hôte being very delightful, of one being certain to meet pleasant people there. It may be so. For many years I believed it was so. The general verdict received my assent. I had never met those delightful people, but was always expecting to meet them. Hitherto they had been conspicuous by their absence. According to my experience in Spain, France, and Germany, such dinners had been drearier, noisy, and vapid. If the guests were English, they were chillingly silent, or surlily monosyllabic. To their neighbors they were frigid. Amongst each other they spoke in low undertones. And if the guests were foreigners, they were noisy, clattering, and chattering, foolish for the most part, and vivaciously commonplace. I don't know which made me feel most dreary. The predominance of my countrymen gave the dinner the gaiety of a funeral. The predominance of the masseuse gave it the fatigue of got-up enthusiasm, of trivial expansiveness. To hear strangers imparting the scraps of erudition and connoisseurship which they had that morning gathered from their valets de place and guidebooks, or describing the sights they had just seen, to you, who either saw them yesterday, or would see them tomorrow, could not be permanently attractive. My mind refuses to pasture on such food with gusto. I cannot be made to care what the Herr Baron's sentiments about Albert Dürer or Lucas Cranach may be. I can digest my Rindfleisch without the aid of the Comus Voyager's criticisms on Gothic architecture. This may be my misfortune. In spite of the Italian blood which I inherit, I am a shy man, shy as the purest Briton. But, like other shy men, I make up in obstinacy what may be deficient in expansiveness. I can be frightened into silence, but I won't be dictated to. You might as well attempt the persuasive effect of your eloquence upon a snail who has withdrawn into his shell at your approach, and will not emerge till his confidence is restored. To be told that I must see this, and ought to go there, because my casual neighbor was charmed, has never presented itself to me as an adequate motive. From this you readily gather that I am severely taciturn at a table d'hôte. I refrain from joining in the delightful conversation which flies across the table, and know that my reticence is attributed to insular pride. It is really and truly nothing but impatience of commonplace. I thoroughly enjoy good talk, but, ask yourself, what are the probabilities of hearing that rare thing in the casual assemblage of 40 or 50 people, not brought together by any natural affinities or interests, but thrown together by the accident of being in the same district, and in the same hotel? They are not 40 feeding like one, but like 40. They have no community, except the community of commonplace. No, tables d'hôte are not delightful, and do not gather interesting people together. Such has been my extensive experience. But this at Nuremberg is a conspicuous exception. At that table there was one guest who, on various grounds, personal and incidental, remains the most memorable man I ever met. From the first he riveted my attention in an unusual degree. He had not, as yet, induced me to emerge from my habitual reserve, for in truth, although he riveted my attention, he inspired me with a strange feeling of repulsion. I could scarcely keep my eyes from him, yet, except the formal bow on sitting down and rising from the table, I had interchanged no sign of fellowship with him. He was a young Russian, named Burkhanov, as I at once learned. Rather handsome, and peculiarly arresting to the eye, partly from an air of settled melancholy, especially in his smile, the amiability of which seemed breaking from under clouds of grief, and still more so from the mute appeal to sympathy in the empty sleeve of his right arm, which was looped to the breast button of his coat. His eyes were large and soft. He had no beard or whisker, and only delicate mustaches. The sorrow, quiet but profound, the amiable smile and the lost arm, were appealing details which at once arrested attention and excited sympathy. But to me this sympathy was mingled with a vague repulsion, occasioned by a certain falseness in the amiable smile, and a furtiveness in the eyes, which I saw or fancied, and which, with an inexplicable reserve, forming as it were the impregnable citadel in the center of his outwardly polite and engaging manner, gave me something of that vague impression which we express by the words instinctive antipathy. It was, when calmly considered, eminently absurd. To see one so young, and by his conversation so highly cultured and intelligent, condemned to early helplessness, his food cut up for him by a servant, as if he were a child, naturally engaged pity, and, on the first day, I cudgeled my brains during the greater part of dinner in the effort to account for his lost arm. He was obviously not a military man. The unmistakable look and stoop of a student told that plainly enough. Nor was the loss one dating from early life. He used his left arm too awkwardly for the event, not to have had a recent date. Had it anything to do with his melancholy? Here was a topic for my vagabond imagination, and endless were the romances woven by it during my silent dinner. For the reader must be told of one peculiarity in me, because to it much of the strange complications of my story are due, complications into which a mind less active in weaving imaginary hypotheses, to interpret casual and trifling facts would never have been drawn. From my childhood I have been the victim of my constructive imagination, which has led me into many mistakes and some scrapes. Because, instead of contenting myself with plain, obvious evidence, I have allowed myself to frame hypothetical interpretations, which, to acts simple in themselves, and explicable on ordinary motives, render the simple-seeming acts portentous. With bitter pangs of self-reproach I have at times discovered that a long and plausible history constructed by me, relating to personal friends, has crumpled into a ruin of absurdity by the disclosure of the primary misconception on which the whole history was based. I have gone, let us say, on the supposition that two people were secretly lovers. On this supposition my imagination has constructed a whole scheme to explain certain acts, and one fine day I have discovered indubitably that the supposed lovers were not lovers, but confidants of their passions in other directions, and, of course, all my conjectures have been utterly false. The secret flush of shame at failure has not, however, prevented my falling into similar mistakes immediately after. When, therefore, I hereafter speak of my constructive imagination, the reader will know to what I am alluding. It was already busy with Burkhanov. To it must be added that vague repulsion, previously mentioned. This feeling abated on the second day, but, although lessened, it remained powerful enough to prevent my speaking to him. Whether it would have continued to abate until it disappeared, as such antipathies often disappear, under the familiarities of prolonged intercourse, without any immediate appeal to my amour proper, I know not, but every reflective mind, conscious of being accessible to antipathies, will remember that one certain method of stifling them is for the object to make some appeal to our interest or our vanity. In the engagement of these more powerful feelings, the antipathy is quickly strangled. At any rate, it is so in my case, and was so now. On the third day, the conversation at table happening to turn, as it often turned, upon St. Sebald's Church, a young Frenchman, who was criticizing its architecture with fluent dogmatism, drew Bergenhoff into the discussion, and thereby elicited such a display of accurate and extensive knowledge, no less than delicacy of appreciation, that we were all listening spellbound. In the midst of this triumphant exposition, the irritated vanity of the Frenchman could do nothing to regain his position, but oppose a flat denial to a historical statement made by Bergenhoff, backing his denial by the confident assertion that all the competent authorities held with him. At this point Bergenhoff appealed to me, and in that tone of deference so exquisitely flattering from one we already know to be superior, he requested my decision, observing that, from the manner in which he had seen me examine the details of the architecture, he could not be mistaken in his confidence that I was a connoisseur. All eyes were turned upon me. As a shy man, this made me blush. As a vain man, the blush was accompanied with delight. It might easily have happened that such an appeal, acting at once upon shyness and ignorance, would have inflamed my wrath. But the appeal happening to be directed on a point which I had recently investigated and thoroughly mastered, I was flattered at the opportunity of a victorious display. The pleasure of my triumph diffused itself over my feelings towards him who had been the occasion of it. The Frenchman was silenced. The general verdict of the company was too obviously on our side. From this time the conversation continued between Bergenhoff and myself, and he not only succeeded in entirely dissipating my absurd antipathy, which I now saw to have been founded on purely imaginary grounds, for neither the falseness nor the furtiveness could now be detected, but he succeeded in captivating all my sympathy. Long after dinner was over, and the salle empty, we sat smoking our cigars, and discussing politics, literature, and art in that suggestive desultory manner which often gives a charm to casual acquaintances. It was a stirring epoch, that of February, 1848. The revolution, at first so hopeful, and soon to manifest itself in failure so disastrous, was hurrying to an outburst. France had been for many months agitated by cries of electoral reform, and by indignation at the corruption and scandals in high places. The Praslin murder, and the dishonor of M. Tiste, terminated by suicide, had been interpreted as signs of the coming destruction. The political banquets given in various important cities had been occasions for inflaming the public mind, and to the far-seeing, these banquets were interpreted as the sounds of the tocsin. Louis-Philippe had become odious to France, and contemptible to Europe. Gizet and Duchatel, the ministers of that day, although backed by a parliamentary majority on which they blindly relied, were unpopular, and were regarded as infatuated even by their admirers in Europe. The Spanish marriages had all but led to a war with England. The opposition, headed by Thiers and Odilon Barrett, was strengthened by united action with the Republican Party, headed by Ledru Rollin, Marist, Floken, and Louis Blanc. Bergenhoff was an ardent Republican. So was I, but my color was of a different shade from his. He belonged to the Reds. My own dominant tendencies being artistic and literary, my dream was of a republic in which intelligence would be the arch and the ruler, and, of course, in such a republic, art, and literature, as the highest manifestation of mind, would have the supreme direction. Do you smile, reader? I smile now, but it was serious earnest with me then. It is unnecessary to say more on this point. I have said so. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.